Today is Monday, December 28th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinua Igofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, the European Union officially begins mass COVID-19 vaccination.
On this first day, those who got the precious vaccine included a 29-year-old nurse at a hospital in the Italian capital.
Also ahead, Nigerians await results of presidential and legislative elections.
Where they're counting the votes, they don't have lights. They are using their phone, the flashlight from their phones to count the votes.
Plus, U.S. President Donald Trump signs COVID relief bill into law. These stories and more are next. We start in Europe, where COVID-19 vaccinations programs are underway. France is vaccinating its citizens as part of the 27-member European Union mass COVID-19 program, which began on Sunday. It is hoped that by the end of 2021, all adults in the bloc will have received the vaccine. Journalist Catherine Field reports the rollout, however, is tinged with concern.
On this first day, those who got the precious vaccine included a 29-year-old nurse at a hospital in the Italian capital. And in Paris, it was a 78-year-old resident of a hospital long-term care ward. In the Czech Republic, it was the Prime Minister who received the first inoculation, an attempt to encourage his countrymen to do the same. Only a small number of people were immunized, a symbolic start, but a powerful image, a sign of optimism in a continent that has lost 350,000 lives to COVID since February, its health services strained to the limit, and its economic and cultural life crippled. In the first wave of vaccinations, those who will get preference will be frontline healthcare workers and the elderly who live in care homes, the biggest single source of death from COVID. Then there will be the second wave, expected in around a month, when elderly people who live outside care homes will be offered the vaccine. The head of the EU's Executive Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, hailed the good news about vaccines, but also delivered a blunt warning.
Once enough people have been vaccinated, we can start traveling, meeting our friends and family again, and have normal holidays, which we all long for. But until then, we have to continue being careful. We need to protect ourselves and our loved ones from the virus. Let's stay safe together.
Von der Leyen's message of caution coincides with alarming figures. In recent weeks, cases of COVID have soared in Europe, and many of its citizens will be seeing in the new year under curfew or in lockdown. A new strain of the virus, first found in Britain, has now been detected on the continent. Scientists say the strain is more contagious, although right now there is no evidence to say it's more lethal. The goal is that by the end of 2021, every single adult in the EU will have been immunized against coronavirus. Vaccinations in Europe will be free, paid by national health services. But the logistics are huge, and some citizens worry about the speed at which the vaccine was developed. In France, the goal is to vaccinate 1 million people by the end of January and 14 million more, or a quarter of the population, by the end of February. But opinion polls suggest only 54% of the French population say they will take the vaccine, compared with 64% in Italy and Spain. Others, though, have reservations. Catherine Field for VOA News, Paris.
Italians began to receive COVID-19 vaccines Sunday after the first batch of nearly 10,000 doses arrived. Italians hope that the massive vaccination campaign will soon bring an end to lockdowns and return them to their normal lives. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
A 29-year-old nurse was the first to receive the vaccine at Rome's Lazzaro Spallanzani National Institute for Infectious Diseases. Health workers at hospitals across the country were next. The government's plan is for health staff and workers and elderly residents in nursing homes to be the first in line. Those over 80 will follow, then 60 to 70-year-olds, and those who suffer from chronic illnesses. Next will be the general population, starting with school staff, police forces, and prison workers. with more than 50% of Italians now saying that they will get inoculated, and that number on the rise. The hope is that in 9 months, Italy will reach herd immunity with 70% of the population vaccinated, a total of 42 million people. The country's first allocated 9,750 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine arrived at the Salvo d'Acquisto military base late on Christmas night. A van with the first batch of vaccines was escorted by police cars to the Spallanzani Hospital in Rome. Italian soldiers loaded other boxes of the vaccine onto military cargo planes for distribution all over the country. Five planes took off from the military base of Pratica di Mare near Rome. Domenico Arcuri, Italy's special commissioner for the COVID-19 emergency, said that with the arrival of the first batch of the vaccine, Sunday would be a symbolic and emotional day. Arcuri said the first doses arrived after a long night. He said Italians are seeing the first ray of light, but the road is still a long one before day arrives. It is important, he added, for this symbolic vaccination to begin, and this campaign will continue over the next months to lead the country out of this emergency. Italy is planning to set up pavilions in its artistic squares to dispense vaccines against COVID-19. The primrose-shaped pavilions were designed by architect Stefano Boeri, who said his team had picked the flower which heralds the arrival of spring as the symbol of the campaign, whose slogan is, "Italy is reborn with a flower." There will be around 300 distribution sites in Italy, rising to 1,500 once the vaccination campaign is at its peak. Boeri, famous for designing Milan's vertical forest skyscraper, said the pavilions would be powered with solar energy and built with recyclable materials such as timber and fabric. He did not charge for his work. More than 71,000 people have died in Italy since the start of the outbreak in February. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
In the United Kingdom, deaths and hospitalizations are still going up amid countrywide vaccinations. The country is grappling with a more virulent variant of the COVID-19 virus. I spoke with VOA's Henry Ridgewell on the vaccination effort.
Government at the moment is sticking with its vaccination plans despite the emergence of this new variant in Britain. That means that the priority groups, the over 80s, the clinically vulnerable, particularly the residents of care homes and frontline health and nursing home workers, are front of the queue and they are being vaccinated as the priority group. Now, there have been some calls for the government to adjust their vaccination strategy because of the emergence of this new strain, some suggesting that the vaccination should be focused geographically on the areas where the outbreak has taken place, which are London and the southeast of England. But the picture is quite bleak in the UK at the moment in terms of the outbreak, despite the optimism of the vaccinations.
How worrying is the emergence of this variant, and how has that affected the government's calculation or recalculation of its COVID-19 plans?
The government scientists say the emergence of this new variant is worrying for two reasons, really. Firstly, that it seems to be replacing the old variant very rapidly, indicating that it's much more infectious. Secondly, what's changed about this mutation of the virus is the actual protein spikes on the surface of the virus, which allow it to infect human cells. And it seems to be much more effective infecting humans and potentially much more effective in reproducing itself and then passing on. It is also more concerning not only for Britain, but for other countries as well. There have been isolated cases detected in several other countries, Denmark, the Netherlands, Australia, among others. But those will be the tip of the iceberg. There will likely be many further cases, and it will be very difficult for other countries to try to keep this new variant of the virus out. Much of the country now is under what the government calls tier four restrictions, which means you're supposed to stay at home. We're back really to where we were in spring again, and we don't have an end date for these measures.
Have you observed within the overall population what is generally known here in the United States as COVID fatigue?
in terms of either going out or just staying indoors and not being able to go out and live life as normal.
Yes, absolutely. There's been a definite change in public attitude, I think, towards the restrictions. When these restrictions were first brought in at the end of March this year, you saw people on their doorsteps applauding the National Health Service weekly. You saw far fewer cars on the road. I was traveling for work purposes. The freeways and the highways were all empty of cars. Now, despite similar restrictions being in place, although they are slightly looser, but despite those restrictions being in place, there are far more people out and about. It's very easy to spot groups of people in parks, supposedly, purportedly breaking the rules. So there is definitely a level of a coronavirus fatigue. I think not only because the restrictions have taken their toll on people's ability to socialize, people are desperate to see their friends and family, but also because of there's recognition of the economic damage as well.
In terms of trips to France, how is that working out, especially when you factor in the variant and efforts to contain it within Britain?
So the blockade at Dover and Calais of the lorries travelling back to France has ended, but only on the condition that those truck drivers test negative for the coronavirus using PCR tests, which takes some time to process this. So there has been a backlog, which still has not shifted entirely from Dover-Calais. So you've had these very sad scenes of truck drivers spending Christmas on the roadside in Britain. There have been some well-wishers and some charities that have provided them with some food and so on. But there have been thousands of truck drivers stuck here.
That's VOA's Henry Ridgewell speaking from London. The World Health Organization urged nations to prepare for the inevitable future pandemics as it marked the first International Day of Epidemic Preparedness on Sunday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA in Geneva.
If we fail to prepare, we're preparing to fail. Last year, the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board published its first report, which concluded the world remains dangerously unprepared for a global pandemic.
In a video statement to launch the International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warns nations against lurching from one outbreak to another while doing nothing to prepare and prevent this from happening. He calls this dangerously short-sighted. A year after being detected in Wuhan, China, the coronavirus has spread widely. The impact on the world's health and economic well-being has been devastating. Latest World Health Organization figures put the number of global infections at more than 80 million cases, including over 1.7 million deaths. Despite these grim statistics, the development of efficacious and safe vaccines is raising hopes the COVID-19 pandemic will be relegated to the history books in the coming months. While Tedros shares these hopes, he advises people to temper their optimism.
History tells us that this will not be the last pandemic, and epidemics are a fact of life. All countries must invest in preparedness capacities to prevent, detect, and mitigate emergencies of all kinds, whether they be natural occurring epidemics or deliberate events.
The WHO chief says the only way to defeat the current outbreak and prepare for the next is for all countries to work together in a spirit of solidarity. This, he adds, means involving and respecting the needs of all nations, rich and poor alike. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. China's foreign ministry Monday said the United States should stop using Taiwan to meddle in China's domestic affairs after U.S. President Donald Trump signed legislation that includes the Taiwan Assurance Act of 2020. Ministry spokesman Zhao Lian made the comment at a daily news briefing in Beijing. The act was included in a $2.3 trillion pandemic aid and spending package signed by Trump on Sunday. Azerbaijan's defense ministry said on Monday that one serviceman had been killed in an attack in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Asked about media reports on Sunday of a possible clash between ethnic Armenian and Azeri forces in the region, Armenian authorities said no such incident had taken place. The European Union was set to begin consultations today to discuss the Brexit agreement and the process of ratifying it. Britain and the European Union struck a trade deal on Christmas Eve at the European Parliament. A meeting was scheduled for Monday morning to see how and when lawmakers will be able to vote on the deal. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. After a delay, President Trump has signed the COVID-19 relief and government funding legislation. AP correspondent Mike Garcia reports.
The long-awaited COVID relief package that President Donald Trump threw in doubt is now law after Trump signed the $900 billion package Sunday at his private club in Florida. The bill includes $1.4 trillion to fund federal agencies through September and includes end-of-session priorities such as an increase in food stamp benefits. Trump held up the bill by demanding $2,000 relief checks instead of the $600 checks in the bill that passed both houses of Congress. In a written statement, Trump said he was sending back to Congress a redlined version of the bill with items he wants removed, but the bill as signed will not necessarily be changed. Mike Garcia, Washington.
Hundreds are reported dead in a wave of violence last week in Ethiopia's Banishagul-Gumuz region. The violence in Banishagul-Gumuz took place amid reports of atrocities committed during intense fighting between government and rebels further north in Ethiopia's Tigray region since November. For the latest, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to VOA Salem Solomon in Washington.
The regional Red Cross says 222 people have died so far, but who has been responsible for the killings is not really clear. Residents who have spoken to our VOA Amharic service say that they blame militiamen and also, regional government actors. VOA Amharic also spoke to the head of the region's peace and security office. His name is Gashu Dugas. He told our service that even though some of the perpetrators are born or raised in the region, they're taking straight directives from the TPLF, who's the Tigray People's Liberation Front, also accused of basically treason and holding the federal government called an illegal election just recently, which escalated into an all-out conflict with airstrikes and over 900,000 now displaced from the region. So this is happening in the midst of that.
And what's behind this violence?
Fundamentally, land. Land has been an issue in the country for quite some time. Most people rely on agriculture for their daily lives. In fact, right before the Banishagul-Gumuz attacks that we're hearing recently, we hear spates of attacks in different parts of the country.
Now, how has the federal government in Addis, led by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, responded to this latest violence?
Abiy Ahmed visited the region, had a discussion with regional authorities and elders, community leaders, all of them. They formed a federal, basically to return security into the region. And in that operation, 40 men were suspected of perpetrating attacks or linked to the massacre were killed, but many also were apprehended or detained in the process of this. And some of the people that are either injured or captured by this operation were members of the community, from what residents are saying.
And so what's next moving forward?
The country is now looking at an election in June 5 to have some sort of federal organized election, and regional leadership will also be affected by the upcoming election. What that looks like in the future is really interesting to see, because what these attacks mean is displacement of people. So if it continues in this trajectory of continued attacks, it doesn't look promising that stability will be coming to all these regions anytime soon.
That's my colleague, Jason Patinkin, speaking with VOA's Horn of Africa Service reporter, Solomon Salem, in Washington. Nigerians are awaiting the results of Sunday's presidential and legislative elections. The voting was largely peaceful, despite some challenges. For more, I spoke with VOA's Hausa Service reporter, Mahmoud Lalo.
This seems, it looks peaceful, it's orderly, everything is going on smoothly. What I'm seeing here are the election officials, delegates from different parties, representing their various parties to make sure that everything is going on smoothly without any hitches. That is what is going on right now. And one funny thing, I don't know. They still, where they're counting the votes, they don't have lights. They are using their phone, the flashlight from their phones to count the votes. That's one bizarre thing that I noticed. There's no light in the place, but then people are still going on with the work and everything.
Have they given you any idea when the results will be out?
I spoke to an official of the CENI this morning. He told me that the election result will be out in the next 5 days. That's what the Niger electoral law says. But then immediately after releasing the results from now, maybe tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, they're going to hand over the results to the Constitutional Court, which will announce the final result officially. What they do in Niger, the process is as soon as all votes are collated and sent to CENI, CENI will count the vote and announce who won the election, but not to the public. They will say so-so person, candidate, so-so candidate won the election. They will then hand over the results to the Constitutional Court, which will look at the result and make sure that it tallies the way it's supposed to be before they finally announce what the official result will be.
Overall, how was the election? How would you rate this election?
I think I would give it 80 out of 100, Chinedu, because I must confess that everything went on smoothly. From opening the polls to the closing, there was no hitches, except that in some few places, there are pockets of late opening of the polls. But then at the end of the day, they were able to start the election and everything went on smoothly, not any hitches. I've noticed a lot of security men stationed in various polling units just to ensure that everything goes on smoothly. Overall, I would say it was a peaceful election in Chinedu.
That's VOA's Hausa Service reporter Mahmoud Lalo speaking with me from Niamey. A Chinese court handed a 4-year jail term on Monday to a citizen journalist who reported from Wuhan during the peak of the city's coronavirus outbreak. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
A Chinese citizen journalist who covered the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan has been jailed for 4 years. 37-year-old Cheng Chan was found guilty on Monday of picking quarrels and provoking trouble, her lawyer said. Cheng's first-hand accounts of crowded hospitals, empty streets and interviews with residents painted a more dire picture of the situation in Wuhan than the official narrative. But her channel on YouTube also got her in the crosshairs of Chinese authorities. She was detained in mid-May and went on hunger strike in June, court documents reveal. Her lawyers told the court police strapped her arms down and force-fed her through a tube. By December, she was suffering headaches, giddiness, stomachache, low blood pressure and a throat infection. Requests for bail before Monday's trial were denied. There was tight security outside the court in Shanghai, but one man turned up to show her support before he was escorted away.
I came here to try and see her. I went there just now, but the staff told me it's not allowed, especially not in a criminal case.
Cheng is one of several citizen journalists who have run into trouble for reporting on Wuhan. China has come under fire for its early handling of the pandemic, with Beijing accused of failing to warn the world about how bad the situation was. Since the first cases of COVID were detected in Wuhan last December, the disease has spread worldwide, infecting more than 80 million people and killing over 1.7 million.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. Trials have begun in southern China for 10 people accused of attempting to flee Hong Kong by speedboats amid a government crackdown on dissent. The defendants face charges of illegally crossing the border, while two face additional charges of organizing the attempt. A spokesperson for the Yantian District People's Court in Shenzhen, just across the border from Hong Kong, said the trials had begun Monday afternoon as scheduled and were ongoing. Two minors arrested with the group will be tried later. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer Nadia Taha, our colleague Jason Patinkin, and our managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Okoh in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.